This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, you're listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. And today I have two guests, Mr. J. Warwick Sweeney and Jim Pennington. Jim Pennington, publisher at ALO's Books, not of ALO's Books. And Jim has brought along Mr. Sweeney, him being the author of a recently published book called Hardy Tree on the Brackett Press imprint, or in the Brackett Press imprint. How should I say that?
That's fine.
Okay.
That's very good.
Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you.
Jim, perhaps you'd like to give us a brief précis of the book.
Well, I'm very much a Burroughs person, and it's wonderful to see this book, which is essentially about Dr. John Yerbury Dent, written by his grandson Warwick, and tells the story of William Burroughs's treatment for drug addiction using apomorphine. But there's a hell of a lot more in the book than that. There is a wonderful description about quite early Edwardian life in London and up north.
Yeah.
And intriguing descriptions of how the drug and medical world worked in the 50s and 60s.
Can I just butt in
interrupt
there?
Please, please do, yes.
There's a wonderful connection between Jim and the story, because I met Jim quite a few years ago now because of my emerging interest in this story, which was largely, I felt, misrepresented. And Jim and I went to the October Gallery. And there was an exhibition of Burroughs's splatter paintings. Is that the correct way to
Were they describe? The ones that were done with a shotgun?
Yes. Well, I think he put tins of paint in front of hardboard or something and shot the paint. Anyway, the interesting thing, though, and the connection between Jim and my family is interesting, because Jim's surname, Pennington, is the village just outside Rampside, where my great-great-grandfather was a minister in the Methodist Church.
Right.
And he was born in Pennington. He came from Pennington. And that's true.
Well, I wish I could say I came from Pennington. I've got grandparents who were called Pennington, and they were from Liverpool, which isn't that far from
You see, that county is either in Cumbria or in Lancashire.
Okay.
Yeah, so nobody really knows. The border runs right through the village Rampside.
I must go up there one of these days, see if I can go to the pub and get some drinks on credit or something.
Well, on the basis of your name, you walk in the pub and say, "My name's Pennington.
Pennington, I demand a free drink.
We've been waiting for you." Okay. So how did you two meet?
Well, who introduced us? I can't remember.
I don't know. I think you introduced yourself.
No, didn't you contact me or something?
I'll tell you what happened. I was Googling around, as one does, and I came across your blog site.
Ah, right.
And I actually left a comment about, yes. I can't remember what it was exactly, how I commented it, but clearly it was obvious that I was knew a little bit about Dr. Dent and APO. And
Jim is a great guy for research. He yes. will go where no one else will dig.
Right, yeah. I noticed he is thanked in the book. You are one of the, in the acknowledgements,
absolutely,
it does say thank you.
Jim sourced the portrait of Burroughs, which blesses the cover.
Yeah. I should just say briefly, because I suspect you guys are going to be able to talk the hind legs off me, and I've only had the book for about 2 days. I haven't really done it justice, but it seems to be very well written.
Thank you.
It's a substantial book, shall we say. I mean, it's pretty, how many pages have we got? 395 pages. It's called The Hardy Tree.
Yes.
And as yet, I haven't ascertained why.
No. Well, Hardy is a metaphor for my grandfather, fundamentally. He was a hardy character, you know, heart of oak and all that stuff. He was a pretty sturdy bloke. People who met him never really forgot him. But I'm wary of the term charismatic, because people have tended to think that he was a successful doctor due to his charisma. I would refute that totally. And it's very interesting to note that when Burroughs met my grandfather, neither knew anything about the other.
Okay.
And that's a really important point. In fact, it's more significant than that, because if you read the nurse's notes, you realize that Burroughs was completely against the treatment he was being given. Okay. He did not believe in it at all. He thought he was being shafted. And I think a lot of that would go back to Burroughs's experience of doctors who were like vultures, really. They sat on the misfortune of people and profited from it. And I think initially Burroughs felt that the wool was being pulled over his eyes, and here was just another old croaker shafting me, and he's going to rip me off and I'll be just as sick at the end of the treatment.
And Burroughs was really shafted at one stage when early on in his when he was living in New York, when he was clearly under emotional stress when he cut the top of his small finger digit on the left hand off with a pair of poultry shears. He was then promptly committed to a hospital. He didn't realise he was going to be committed until everybody he found himself all by himself in a locked room.
How old was he when that happened?
I should know these facts off by heart, but it's like late 20s, early 30s,
and. Yeah.
He honestly thought the doctor was going to treat him and talk to him, but in fact he was left
alone.
Yeah. So the white coat syndrome is something he's been railing against for many years.
And the irony of this is, of course, eventually when Burroughs realizes that Dent is far from this, in actual fact he's a kindred spirit, my grandfather hated doctors himself. You know, he knew very few that he respected. He thought most of them were unethical. He despised the BMC. He didn't make any friends really within the medical fraternity.
But we should say he was a qualified doctor himself.
Yes,
but so he was within the system.
He was within the system, but he was unorthodox. Let's put it that way. I mean, he's thought outside the sort of, I don't know, the framework. He was not hidebound. He was inventive. He was certainly known when he died as a friend to alcoholics. That's in his obituary.
He died in 1962,
yes,
we should say.
Yes, 73.
And Burroughs probably first came to him when, 56 or something?
In 1956, I think Burroughs was 42.
Okay.
Yeah. 42.
Yep. So,
was Burroughs seeking to be cured? It sounds like he didn't.
Yes.
He wanted a cure. He was in a very bad shape.
If he thought he was dying, he'd been a compulsive user of opiates for 12 years.
Right.
And the more that he became hooked, if you like, the more opioids he needed. And this was only going to end one way. Right. And he had tried various ways to get off. That's well documented. Yeah. What isn't really well documented is the doctor that he came to see. In fact, there are many inaccuracies in the existing Barrosian story. And this is certainly one. It's documented in biographies that he went to see a doctor called Maclay. This is true, but there were two Maclays, believe it or not, in this part of West London, in fact, in the same borough. And one was William Maclay, and the other was Walter Maclay. And Walter Maclay was the one he should have gone to see, and he went to see the wrong one. And
it did him a favour.
It did him a favour in the long run, because the one that he should see did recommend him to my grandfather indirectly. And this is really important, because this was a psychiatrist who also, like Dent, was interested in alternative approaches. And there's a story about him, which is sort of may do the rounds again now, because Cumberbatch, what's his Christian name? Dominic Cumberbatch is making a film about...
The actor, Benedict.
Yes, Benedict, thank you. Benedict. He's doing a film about Lewis Wayne. And Lewis Wayne was the cat artist. And Maclay it was who saw the cat paintings in a shop window and thought that this was evidence of Lewis Wayne's mental disintegration. And of course, this was debunked later on. But it's a fascinating story, and that's a film that's going to come out soon. But it is an indication of just how interested Maclay was in, let's say, art and mental health. And of course, there is a dimension to my grandfather's approach which could be regarded as remedial for a whole range of conditions. My grandfather was a pioneer on addiction therapies. He was the first doctor to establish categorically the link between anxiety and addiction, because people were worried about stuff, they self-medicated. And if the worry didn't go away, they carried on drinking or using opiates. And of course, because of tolerance, they needed more and more, and eventually it would become a huge problem. My grandfather knew that if you had to overcome any sort of dependency issue like this, you had to tackle the source of the problem. That meant going back to the beginning. What is the problem? So he would sit down and he would listen to people. And doctors today, sadly, do not have time to sit down and find out if the woman that's just come to see him or her is self-medicating because her husband's abusing her, or because she's got six starving kids she can't feed, or there's a leak in the kitchen and she's freezing cold and winter's coming, or whatever it is. What patients need nowadays is good psychotherapists. They don't need to be over medicalized, which of course is something that has gone on for decades.
But one of the problems with the way that big pharma has managed the situation is to try and come up with alternative substitutes for heroin, which they then have to substitute that substitute. I think the chronology goes morphine to methadone. And now they're trying to find, and one of the alternatives to methadone were the oxytocin things. And so
all these drugs, beyond a shadow of doubt, are similarly addictive. They are not looking at the cause of the problem. It's disgraceful that doctors still are being had. Well, maybe the doctors are having the wool pulled over their eyes as well. I have met GPs who are at their wits' end. They've got a surgery full of people, and the expectation is that the patient will be given a prescription of something which may be an antidepressant. Well, this does not deal with the...
But it is almost an epidemic now, isn't it?
It's beyond that.
I mean, I can think of at least... I could probably think of six or seven people that I know who are on antidepressants.
When my grandfather treated William Burroughs, there were 300 opiate dependents in the whole country.
Registered.
Yes, 300.
Could there have been more that were unregistered? Yes. Or was it impossible to get?
It's impossible to know, yeah. But that was the accepted figure at the time. It was quoted in
and
the Times.
There was not a lot
editorial.
Of illicit heroin coming in either, because it tended to be supplied by spill-off from the overprescribing.
Was it opium, perhaps? Was more of a, you know, sort of off the map, as it were, because that wasn't, you didn't. Was probably easier to get to than heroin?
Don't know.
Okay.
Well, it's a tragedy that's happened in plain sight. Right. And this is the point. Mm. 300 opiate addicts. Currently, that figure is close to 500,000. And this is something that has been legislated for, not against, upheld by spineless politicians, awful governments, one after the other, caving in to the WHO edict that they had to criminalise this as a problem. My grandfather said all this. He predicted what would happen if nobody listened. And, of course, nobody did listen. And look where we are. It's unbelievable. And we are currently, this country is devoting a lot of itself to trying to embrace a Trump Brexit. And a consequence of that will be more vulture capitalism. Mm. And I can give statistics. 45,000 Americans died last year because they had no recourse to any form of health care. This 45,000 people died because they had treatable diseases but couldn't afford any health care. There was no provision. Right. Mm. But it gets worse. 80,000 Americans died last year from drug abuse. Right. Two-thirds of those people, approximately 56,000, their initial contact with opioids was through prescription. Mm. Now, are we going to sign up to that sort of logic? Hmm. You know, that's the ethos that we are currently embracing, and our health service providers need to understand the direction of travel.
Right.
Yeah.
Perhaps we should just to backtrack slightly. Hmm. Your grandfather came up with it, although he trained, I think, as an ophthalmologist.
Yes, that was one of his early areas of interest.
What caused the shift from that to his life as being concerned with addiction?
Well, he was a Quaker. Right. Okay, it's not. It wasn't even well understood within my own family that he was a Quaker. Hmm. So when I researched his life, it became self-evident to me that's partly where his ethos came from. If you look at the five principles of care the principles of belief that Quakers uphold, there's simplicity, pacifism, integrity, community, and equality. SPICE. That's the acronym.
Okay.
There's a sixth one, S, spices. Hmm. Which is stewardship of a discipline. And my grandfather embraced each one of those principles, no doubt about it. He used it to inform his approach to medicine. So his door was always open. He didn't judge people. That was a really important part of why he got through to Burroughs.
Yeah.
He didn't, Burroughs had led a pretty traumatic life. Jim can tell us.
He was in Tangiers, which is where I think his addiction really got the better of him, as a result of leaving Mexico after the death of his wife by a tragic gun accident, and difficult for him to recover.
Wasn't there a sort of a philosophy or an idea that if you stuck to pure drugs, you would be all right? That you could somehow, Aleister Crowley, for example, believed that he could master the drug addiction, but of course it got the better of him in the end.
I suspect that's a wonderful rationalisation on the part of he wanted to keep on taking the stuff.
Yes, exactly.
Because I don't think Burroughs had a lot of access to really pure drugs when he was in Tangiers. He would do the rounds of all the chemists to get the pharmaceutical equivalents, Eucadol and all that. He was an expert. He was a walking MIMS. MIMS, you know, medical something. MIMS is the book that you have in the doctor's surgery, if you're a doctor, to find out which drug it is that's appropriate. It's like a medical drug encyclopedia.
He was an amateur specialist.
Burroughs, certainly. He knew what he was taking,
a funny dimension to that, because my grandfather called Burroughs the master addict. Uh-huh. And that's inscribed in the essay that Burroughs wrote for Dent, which was the first thing that Burroughs ever wrote under his own birth name. And that's a very important part of how my grandfather got into the head of Burroughs and was able to turn his life around, because my grandfather was emphasizing to Burroughs, you do not need to be ashamed of who you are. And pseudonyms, because he wrote under the pseudonym of William Lee, are a bit of a hedge. Yeah. You know, stop that, he said. You know, you've got to cut that out. You are who you are. Be proud of who you are. You know, had journeys.
But the book was Junkie, Confessions of an Unredeemed... isn't that because surely he would have been frightened of being caught, identified as a drug addict.
Letter from a Master Addict was certainly him outing himself as a writer and a person who
But didn't that lead to a degree of law enforcement or whatever on him? Didn't he kind of make him fall foul of the law?
No, quite the opposite. In fact, there is a talk that actually this Letter from a Master Addict was actually written to try and make the authorities think that he was a reformed character, which he was doing his best. But I think he hedged his bets for many years, if not for the rest of his life, actually.
That was Ginsberg's interpretation as well, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we ended up in Paris, stitched up on supposedly the Paris police reckoned that he was part of a drug smuggling operation that involved somebody. I can't remember who the person was in Tangiers, but they were going to bring in vast amounts of dope inside stuffed camels.
But that really, you see, that doesn't really stack up, because Burroughs wrote to Dent in August of 1956 about this essay that he'd written for my grandfather's journal. Right. And so it doesn't really stack up that Ginsberg should be suspicious of Burroughs.
The essay was supposedly in payment, wasn't it?
I'm going to fess up here. That's my interpretation. My grandfather was generous to a fault. I think he would have wanted to find a way to support Burroughs as a writer, and that occurred to me while I was writing the story.
Right.
But I have no proof of that. I'll be absolutely honest. But I think it's absolutely in character of my grandfather.
We should get on to the thing about apomorphine. Where did this come from? How did he discover benefits of it?
We cut short, really, this discussion about my grandfather's moral conviction and whether that simply stemmed from his Quakerism. It wasn't as simple as that, because he was a doctor. And early on in his life, he was dealing with an awful lot of traumatized First World War veterans in hospitals throughout the 1918 up until 1923, when he worked at St. Pancras. It was a huge problem for him, and he seriously struggled with not knowing how to help addicts. And he confronted senior medics, and they would advise him to supply gin addicts with whiskey. And my grandfather was appalled. You know, we are doctors. We're here to help people. This is ridiculous. There has to be a better way. But there was so much resistance within the medical profession generally, because they regarded alcoholism as hopeless, that there was nothing that they could do.
Weak-willed.
Yeah, my grandfather was constantly at odds with senior doctors who were telling him, and there's an essay, part of one of the chapters where in his memoirs, where he talks at length about that. He had very little respect for his elders and betters, and he was constantly at odds with authority, my grandfather. And I think this would be another reason why he got on with Burroughs.
Yeah, at St Pancras Cemetery is where St Pancras Church is where the Hardy Tree.
Yes,
is.
Yeah.
Oh, and, is it? Oh, yeah. Okay.
And I told Warwick not to call it the Hardy Tree because there's already a book called The Hardy Tree by a very very nice poet called Iphigenia Ball.
Well, I dropped the article. The definite article.
Okay.
So, in a way, that I did that for two reasons, because Burroughs did the same with Naked Lunch.
Very good. Yes.
So I felt there was history there.
so he gravitated towards alcoholics. Then he thought this was his calling in some way, or
I think he realised that he had some success, early success. And he treated people with apomorphine because apomorphine is an emetic. And one of the jobs that he had in the St Pancras workhouse was to empty the stomach of alcoholics on a Friday or Saturday night, because they came in absolutely hammered. And quite a lot of them, if left alone, would puke on their own vomit and die, suffocate themselves.
Choke on their own.
Yeah. So it was the first job of all the nurses and doctors who were on duty that night to stomach pump, which was a horrendous job. It was painful. It was an awful performance. There's a description of it in the book. And it horrified my grandfather. And there were some patients who were regulars. They knew what was ahead of them. And one or two were furious with the doctors for doing it. They were violent. You can imagine. And with the particularly difficult cases, he knew that he had this alternative approach to emptying their stomach. And that was to fill them full of apomorphine. So he'd pull down their trousers and inject them in their backsides. And within 2 minutes, their stomachs were absolutely empty. It probably was a high dose. It would guarantee immediate emesis.
Right.
And it was pretty horrific. But what he noticed in the morning, he was able to compare those that had been given the stomach pump and those that had been given apomorphine. And the ones that had been given apomorphine were much more amenable.
And it was physically a pump, wasn't it? They would shove a pipe down your gullet. And
it's a horrible machine, and you'd push on it like
a
stirrup pump.
Should we play this clip at this
clip, Dr. Dent talking, I'll give a little intro to this. This clip comes from a radio programme that was never actually broadcast. It was done around 1961 by a poet called Melville Hardiment, and it was to do with the drug problem in London and England at the time, and the various treatments and how the doctors prescribed it. And but this clip here is where Dr. Dent is talking.
This is Dr. Dent himself.
Yeah,
Warwick's grandfather.
Starts off with Hardiment making a statement, and then Dr. Dent talks.
I'll try and master this.
I think it was a BBC broadcast, yeah?
It was. They never broadcast it, though. Died a death. Don't know why. Probably because it perhaps raised too many questions
the
which they didn't want answering.
The difficulty of effecting complete cure is obviously a result of the combined psychological and biochemical nature of addiction. Most addicts are married to their drug. separation does nothing to dissolve the marriage. Obviously, a counter-drug would be a valuable step to conquering addiction by killing the physical need while other forms of therapy were carried out. But only one doctor, to our knowledge, claims to have found such a chemical cure, and his technique is little practiced elsewhere in the medical profession.
There are two main groups of people who treat addiction. The first think of the disease as mostly a psychological disease. I do not think this. I think it's mostly a chemical disease with psychological overtones. The chemical treatment I advise and use is that with apomorphine, which is a stimulant of the hypothalamus, the part of the brain which regulates the contents of the blood. And when it's not acting very well, which it isn't in excited people, you can give them apomorphine, which makes that blood-regulating center work. And you have to realize that that center is nourished by the blood that it is regulating. So you have to stimulate it for at least 4 days. Then the blood is good enough to feed that hypothalamus so that it can go on regulating without any further stimulation. Why I advocate this treatment is that it is the only one I know in which the man can come into a hospital or nursing home and be treated chemically and have sufficient psychological boost to his morale and go out again in 10 days or less. When I started apomorphine treatment, I thought I was treating it for alcoholism, and I thought it cured people of alcoholism by giving them a distaste for drink. It does, but that is only by the way. I called it an aversion treatment. Apomorphine can be successful and is successful without any aversion being produced at all. You cannot get an aversion to the smell or taste of morphine when you're injecting it into a vein. But nevertheless, the treatment is just as effective. It will prevent that man from suffering from the lack of the morphine. It will remove his need for morphine, and without any aversion at all.
This doctor was unwilling to produce cures, although he did refer us to a private clinic where he's a consultant. The American arch junkie and novelist William Burroughs claims to have been completely cured of his heroin and cocaine addiction by a 10-day treatment with apomorphine under this doctor.
Yes, the clinic that he refers to is one... there was a clinic in London, but there was also a clinic down in Surrey called Spelthorne St Mary, which is run by nuns. And there's some nice clips later on of the Sisters of Mercy, I suppose you might call them, talking about how they would use apomorphine and the people they... interviews with the people there and how they had found themselves so much better.
Well, thank you, Jim. That it's wonderful to hear the old boy's voice. I think it's very revealing, that recording, because he does say, yes, it's a chemical treatment, but twice he says within that very short clip that it gives him the opportunity to dig around in terms of giving them the psychosocial support, the psychotherapeutic support. Mm-hmm. And that was hugely important. And, you know, I've met so-called addiction specialists now who think that my grandfather was only concerned in the biochemical. It's rubbish. I mean, these people stand in my grandfather's shoes, but they're not able to lace them. They're unbelievably dense, these people. The evidence is there, you know, but they've never, ever questioned
why
this.
Do you think it hasn't caught on then as a treatment? as it were.
Okay, it's a generic drug. Nobody's going to get rich out of using apomorphine.
Oh,
that's right.
What does that mean? What do you mean by a generic drug? What is that?
A pharmaceutical company cannot patent it.
Ah.
Though it can be made cheaply.
The treatment is also incredibly quick, as my grandfather, just 4 days. Burroughs was turned around actually in 8.
Right.
He probably stayed in the clinic for a couple more days, but he felt so, so much better. I think he
So is the suggestion that this has sort of been suppressed because there's no money in it?
Well, it's very hard to deny that when you look at the evidence. Most of the doctors who were committed to being opponents to my grandfather in the early days were owners of rich rest homes where people would stay in luxurious accommodations, spending an awful lot of money. My grandfather could not abide that. It was difficult.
So it's in some people's interests to have people ill.
To maintain illness. And of course, that's what maintenance therapies do.
Right.
You know, it's a provision of as I said, his advice in the early days was to give gin addicts whiskey. And then throughout the 40s, 50s and 60s, they were interested in methadone.
Right.
Deaths from methadone alone, it's just a disgrace, really.
Right.
Keeps you locked into control. Can we play Spellthorn 1?
Yes, indeed.
This is down in the Sisters of Mercy.
Just before we play this, the criticism of my grandfather, oh, yes, he was successful because he was charismatic. I imagine this recording, though I've never heard it, will blow a huge hole in that because this was a treatment provided by other people who weren't even doctors. You know.
Yeah.
The only ray of light we found in this bleak and depressing scene was provided by the private clinic for women which I mentioned just now. It's called Spellthorn St. Mary and is run by a community of Anglican nuns. Their main work is with alcoholics, but about 10 of their 60 or so patients are drug addicts.
If the addiction is to one of the opium derivatives, the treatment consists first of all in a very patient and gradual withdrawal until it's possible to cut it out altogether. This may take 3 months. And it needs a great deal of patience, both on the part of the patient and her nurses. Generally, over the last stages, she's helped by having small doses of a more innocuous drug, which is easily discontinued afterwards.
Are there any other chemical agents you employ?
Yes, apomorphine can be very useful in getting people off the last stages of a tapered withdrawal. And once a person has learnt to use it, it's very useful. In fact, it's invaluable in coping with the physiological craving period that's apt to occur from time to time.
When they come downstairs after that, the rehabilitation begins, and that's a very important part of the work. We set them to work in various parts of the house or garden. We find for the younger and stronger people that outdoor work is quite the best because they are people who've not been sleeping and it makes them tired and they sleep. They've not been eating, it makes them hungry and they eat. And they love the work. They are free and it's constructive work and they enjoy it very much. And some of them have even taken up gardening professionally when they've left.
Do you notice any marked change in their attitude to things like dress as time goes on?
Yes. Very great. And for that reason, we really do try to make the place as pretty as possible and try and give them pride in keeping it nice because they've all got slammocky and careless in their appearance and in their habits. And it's very important to get them to take a pride in things and a pride in their appearance.
I haven't heard that word years.
I don't think I've heard it
at all.
That is brilliant. That is marvellous. What a wonderful recording. And that is corroborated by so many other people who used apomorphine on addicts. I've forgotten the name of the guy, Swedish, I think. And that tool, I mean, it's extraordinary how similar the reaction was to life by people who were treated with apomorphine, and how quick the turnaround was.
Mm. And there were treatments going on even after Dr. Dent died. There were some treatments going on in the 70s, am I right? In Denmark, or was it Sweden?
There was a Danish small independent pharmaceutical company, which was possible up until, I think, the late 70s, where they made apomorphine capsules. Mm. This was to prolong the effect of apomorphine in the stomach, so oral apomorphine. What doctors never ask me is, why did your grandfather use apomorphine? Well, it's self-evident that he saw the benefits of it, but it goes much deeper than that. Apomorphine is not dangerous. You know, yeah. I constantly hear about people telling me, well, all these drugs are very dangerous. There is no such thing as a safe drug. Mm. Apomorphine, oral apomorphine, mind, if you take too much of it, you throw
just
up.
Throw up.
You see? And so.
But isn't that. I thought that was sort of how it worked. I thought it was a kind of an aversion thing.
No.
It's not.
It's almost as if it goes. It's not. It's wrong to say it's something like a homeopathic. You have to. You try to get down to the very smallest dose, but it's not like that. But yeah, you.
Does it replace the drug that it's trying to wean you off?
There's evidence that it reduces anxiety. I think that's pretty well established.
And you sleep a lot better.
Well, that's interesting, because the basis of this whole thing is that people start with anxiety, and that's what causes the addictions to whatever it might be.
Yeah, and
so if you cure the anxiety, you cure the craving for whatever the addiction,
well,
addictive substance is.
Well, maybe part of the anxiety is the worry that you will not be able to find the drug that will keep the pain at bay. The pain of withdrawal.
Right.
Now, Dent, I believe, based on what I understand, would often trap the patient to come to the clinic by promising him or her that he would give them their drug of choice when they needed it, as long as they did their best to not take any. So when he meets Burroughs, I think that's how he trapped him.
Right.
He said, Burroughs is desperate for it. He's come to a strange city. He doesn't know where to find it. My grandfather gives him some and then says, come to my clinic and I'll give you as much as you want.
Okay. But anything calling itself morphine, I don't know anything about drugs, but this is called apomorphine.
Yes.
And you're saying that it eliminates anxiety.
Yes.
So why do you then stop taking the apomorphine? Because that's going to make you feel better.
Because it's not addictive.
But wouldn't the anxiety return once you stopped taking the apomorphine?
Probably not.
Well, an interesting question. I'm glad you've brought it up. Mm. The properties of morphine are not the same as apomorphine. Oh. And I think it's one of the problems of the image of apomorphine is that it has this suffix morphine.
Yeah.
But it is derived from morphine.
Okay.
It's boiled at 140 degrees centigrade with hydrochloric acid. Mm. And that is what apomorphine becomes. There's a molecular switch at that point. And that's how you make the drug.
Right.
But it does not have any of the properties of morphine. It is not a painkiller and it's not a psychotropic drug. You cannot hallucinate. It's not a stimulant in that way.
Right.
And the FDA put it on their list of banned drugs precisely because it had morphine in it. They didn't understand it as being anything other than...
Do you want to play this next clip or not? Is that
I think it's quite nice, the Spellthorn 2, where you have the lady talking about how she started taking heroin. It's a little social snapshot of the people who were being treated at Spelthorne at the time.
She's an attractive woman in her late 30s or early 40s and is living in a quiet seaside resort. A widow twice over, she now has her mother living with her.
I was born abroad, and the East always fascinated me. And I think I was impressionable as a child, and, of course, my father was very artistic. And, of course, there were things like Buddhas and incense and all that sort of thing about our house. And I was sent home to school, and I missed the East dreadfully, and was very unhappy. And, well, I suppose when I was about 13, 14, I came in contact with the poets, and I was poetical by nature myself, and used to write verse and think it was wonderful. And then, of course, I read of people like Coleridge Taylor and Francis Thompson and those people, and I felt that I had something in common with them, and it was, I can't explain it, but it was a sort of, I felt that by taking drugs in some sort of way I would have some experience that very few people had had before me.
So you you knew of the existence of things like heroin. You must have done, obviously.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Well, what were the exact circumstances? You would know someone to go to or something like that?
No. I was living in London, and it was about wartime, and my husband had just been killed in the war, and I was one of these rather a butterfly gay type, and I wanted to, well, get an extra kick out of life, I suppose.
It's just a super little snapshot. Yes. I'd like to get a little extra kick out of life after my husband had just been killed in the war.
I'm a butterfly gay type. That's lovely.
Irresistible sound clip.
Yes. So what's the story of that clip? When do these date from? Are these from this nursing home in Surrey, is it?
Was that from Spelthorne?
That's from Spelthorne. That's one of the... I think she went on to be a landscape gardener.
Right. So is there a whole archive of these recordings? Are these just...
I think this is the only only recording of... this is a distillation of all the recordings that Melville Hardiman did. There are some other ones of male junkies talking about how to get their dope and how to do this, that, and the other. What we haven't covered, though, Warwick, is the new use of apomorphine as part of the treatment for Parkinson's disease. Is this?
Yeah, well, I knew about that. Professor Andrew Leese had contacted my mother and aunt, I think, in the early 90s. And so I sort of knew a little bit about that and was sort of watching developments. Well, Andrew, of course, I've read books on the treatment of addiction, there is one currently going around. I had to pay about 70 quid for this book, and in it says apomorphine is an aversion therapy and is not approved, and it goes on to say that it has no biochemical effect whatsoever. Andrew could say that that's utter nonsense, because the neurological effect of apomorphine, it is absolutely a given in respect of the treatment for Parkinson's disease. And of course, it is exactly as my grandfather said, it's centered in that part of the hindbrain, which controls all the motor neurons. And that's why people suffer. There's degeneration in that part of the brain, and apomorphine deals with the symptomatic relief. It's not a cure, but it is a treatment, so it allows people to lead relatively normal lives.
Can people choose to go down that road? I mean, if somebody's heard this and said, I want apomorphine, could they find it?
That's a really good question. And the question of patient choice is absolutely central to this. So if you go to a doctor with a heroin problem and they give you a drug which maintains the problem, it's unethical to say to a patient that would go to a doctor and say, well, actually, I'd like apomorphine. I'd like to see how I'd get on with that. I'm sick and tired of being parked on methadone for 30 or 40 years.
Right.
I want relief from this. Well, that's why my grandfather used apomorphine. It wasn't dangerous and it wasn't a maintenance.
But the question
therapy.
Is, can you get it today? Could somebody go to a doctor and say...
I actually believe that no doctor would know what to do.
Ah.
I mean, that's a huge hole in their understanding.
Would it also be available? I mean, if somebody suffering from anxiety, chronic anxiety,
yes.
Would they also be a contender for this?
It's another brilliant question, because I think the whole issue around mental health care and the drugs that currently are being given to people, antidepressants and all the rest of it, I'm not sure that we properly understand the benefit of a drug like apomorphine to all these people.
Right.
It's simply not available because it's not part of...
And is there still no money in it? It's still not, as you say, it's still a generic drug, which so the pharmaceutical companies can't make loads of money on.
Uprima, which is a form of apomorphine, was marketed for erectile dysfunction.
Right.
There is also, there was a urologist up in Scotland who thought that it would be beneficial for women for the same reason. And I think that too is an area that has been buried. I just don't think there's been enough research.
We haven't mentioned one of the side effects of apomorphine is a sense of randomness. And I've no doubt in my mind that Burroughs noticed this as well. Also, he noticed that he was much chirpier after it, because he did a lot of his writing during...
Hand in glove, don't they, really? Being chirpy and...
I think that Jim has hit on something which is, again, it's a dimension of an addict being treated with apomorphine which has been completely buried. Apomorphine is a cognitive enhancer. It stimulates people's ability to remember what has happened to them. It stimulates their ability to learn, you know, and this has to be properly understood. If you take a drug that you know, a lot of people will say, oh, I had a dream last night, but I can't for the life of me remember what it was. It's possible, it's quite conceivable that Burroughs' withdrawal out of heroin, stimulated by apomorphine, allowed him to access the unbelievable flowering of his imagination at that critical moment in his life. I mean, you can see that his writing completely changed. His interest,
energy levels as well.
Yes, energy is a huge part of it. And my grandfather was a holistic therapist, you know, and he pointed him in the way of Hornibrook. We've just heard the evidence of the Spelthorn nuns advocating an outdoor life and gardening. There was interest in things where prior to apomorphine there was no interest.
Right.
So this enthusiasm is a part of it.
I should just say you've been listening to Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM, and today's guests still are Jim Pennington, the publisher at ALOS Books, and Mr. J. Warwick Sweeney, whose book Hardy Tree has just been published. And Hardy Tree is in effect the sort of story of, it's a sort of memoir written from your point of view.
I inherited a memoir from my grandfather.
John Yerbury Dent.
John Yerbury Dent.
And
Yerbury was the Quaker name inherited from his ancestors. But when he died, he gave each of his surviving grandchildren his unpublished memoirs. I believe I have the only surviving copy. It has been copied. So, and when I read that, I would say it's pretty dull reading, actually. It's not very lively. But there are some interesting references in it which appear in Naked Lunch. And this, to me, was evidence of written material that I could corroborate, which showed that my grandfather had had, even though it might have been unconscious on the part of both doctor and patient, that my grandfather did have an impact, not just on Burroughs's health, but also on his writing. You have to remember that my grandfather was a writer himself. Okay. He knew lots of writers. He knew people like Bertrand Russell, H.G. Wells, very well. And he moved in that circle. He had treated many, many other writers successfully. He had failures. There's no doubt about that. One of the best stories is his failure to treat Tony Hancock. Poor old Tony Hancock was sent to him by the BBC, so there was a connection there.
It's interesting. So he was known to, I mean, some people would have known the existence
He was known as an addiction
specialist. Did he have a clinic or a...
He treated people at home, he consulted people at home, and then if he felt, and this is important, if he felt that they would benefit from apomorphine, because, you know, it was an ordeal. Four days being injected.
Went to a clinic on Warwick Road, wasn't it? Or which road was
Cromwell
it?
Cromwell Road.
Cromwell Road.
Yeah.
And when Dr. Dent died, there were some treatments carried on after his death.
Yes.
And they were carried on by the staff nurse, chief nurse, matron. What was her name?
Smithy.
Smithy.
Yeah.
And she appears in... Keith Richards.
Yes, that's true.
his memoir.
His memoir. Because he went for the treatment. Smitty, he called
right,
that.
Right.
That's right. Yeah.
Don't know how successful it was. Maybe it was as successful, but it was totally successful because Keith is still alive.
We should say it's published by Brackett Press.
Yeah, great. They've done a fantastic job. High production values, I tell you. Unbelievable. I'm very proud of it.
Where is it available from?
From Brackett Press.
I
think you can find it on Amazon, but please don't buy it on Amazon. Only buy it from Brackett Press because we've got to help individual small publishers.
I'm going to encourage my local bookshop to take it as well.
Right.
That's Helsons. Really important.
Fair enough.
You know.
Yes. Well, thank you both very much for coming in. We can either end with a Burroughs track, or unless there's something else you'd like to add, you'd like to have another swipe at Big Pharma or something, or if you want to sort of...
Can we play Digging in the Needle?
Is this one of your clips?
Yeah, 1 minute, 58 seconds.
Yes, that's Digging in the Needle. There's two. Is Digging in the Needle Loop? Or
No, don't do Digging in the Needle Loop.
No, okay, all right, okay.
Is this Hardiman?
Yes, no,
this is a junk.
A third full of slightly yellowish, cloudy liquid.
Well, now I hope to be able to hit. But my arms are beginning to get into quite a bad state after years of injecting in that I usually find it very, very hard to hit successfully at any rate. Usually takes quite a few minutes. I have been as long as about half an hour messing about just digging in constantly the whole time, and then at the end of that lose the solution.
The needle's just gone in.
Oh, I'm now just digging about in the hope of hitting a vein.
Does it hurt?
Well, it does in the beginning, but you, like everything else, after a time, you get used to it.
Trying again now.
Yes.
There's some red spreading into the syringe, yes. And now you're taking off the tourniquet.
Uh-huh. Well, if you shoot the solution in without loosening at all the key, you usually end up by getting a huge blister come up on the arm.
Now you're slowly squeezing the...
Squeezing it in. And...
The bulb.
Just now, just before it goes in, I have got the effect, and I'm feeling the effect of it now.
What is the effect that you feel?
Dying in the streets.
Airlines suffer most.
New heart,
through
better consul, brain.
The youth model City returned from the post, pleaded innocent
I
argument with
officers.
Her lawyer and district soldier husband,
you're all empowered to make arrests.
Nay, Bernard
the
Smith,
right shade
when officer direction adjourned today, pending a 3-ton boat bound separate from a passing truck and crushed her convertible.
Soft mendicant words in the
Monday, June 14th, Sydney, Australia.
Ship
sinks under all female crew.
Quinn
and the three girls with him
the
were rescued.
Independence is in the
three girls aboard
the
Cochrane boat
is an
on
American
fatal trip.
Boat.
The shipwrecked hotel.
Speaking clock telling Third you the
tracks
United
on
States
time. Daddy Oilbucks brought his mule 16.
God
Smith had high praise for the police who worked like dogs.
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.